during the rains retreat, it has been a custom for many years now, to spend time just with the novice monks, the Anagarikas and the visitors. So this is one session where the other monks are banned. So even though a few monks wanted to come here, I say no, because I wanted to give access to each one of you, so you have me. And during this time, also we wanted to use the opportunity by exposing everybody who comes to this monastery to basic teachings of Buddhism from the suttas. And so one year I read through what's called the Word of the Buddha, which is an anthology of texts which are structured around the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Gradual Training, which is a very beautiful way of looking at the essential teachings of Buddhism, and the other year to just go through the first 10 sutras of the Majjhima Nikaya. And of course, by doing so, it means that in the two-year training, which everybody has here before they become fully ordained monks, I know that they at least have been exposed to the basic teachings of Buddhism. So at least they've got a grounding. They know what they're ordaining into. And also, by exposing everybody to these sutras, it means you get interested in them. And you don't just see these first 10, but you look at other sutras for yourself, and there you find out exactly what the Buddha actually taught. And of course, many of you have been around Buddhism for long enough to know there is always a lot of discussion about what the Buddha taught, what really Buddhism is. So you can make up your own mind. You can look at these sutras, and these are usually regarded as the most authentic teachings of the historical Buddha. And if we want to find the closest we can get to what the Buddha taught, it's in volumes such as this. And by reading them again and again and again, not just one sutra but many sutras, there's a consistent message which comes from wide reading. And that consistent message is the essential teachings of Buddhism. So it's great that I expose you to this so you can find out for yourself and so you can know what Buddhism truly is. And so obviously you cannot go through all these sutras. So during the rains retreat, I just go through the first 10. And there's a range of sutras there. Some are really interesting, very deep. Some are not so deep, but it just gives you an overview. And the deepest one of these is the very first one, which is why I usually leave that one to the last. And so we're going to start on the second sutta, the Savasava Sutta, called All the Taints. And you see that as we go through this, some of the translations here are brilliant, some are not so good, but I will actually explain some of those translations as we go along. And during every session is an opportunity for you to ask questions, but for the sake of getting these things finished with, we only allow people 3 questions per session. So you're only allowed 3 questions, so use your 3 questions wisely. Otherwise, it goes on and on and on. Okay, so here we go, it's the Savasava Sutta. We do do the Namotasa first of all, as is the custom, to respect these teachings. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we start off with, thus have I heard, Ewamme Sutan. And that is the beginning of every sutta, and that refers to the fact that just after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, around May, the full moon day of May, the monks realized they needed to collect all the disparate teachings which the Buddha had given, and so they went to a rains retreat in the Satapani cave, just outside of Rajagaha, and there for the first couple of months they worked, and then afterwards they did the recitation of the Vinaya and the Sutta. It's said there very clearly that Venerable Upali recited the Vinaya, and the Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas of the Sutta Pitaka. And that was all which was chanted. No Abhidhamma was chanted. Just the Pancha Nikaya. Because everyone knows Pancha Nikaya, Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, which is this set of sutras, the Sanyutta Nikaya and Guttara Nikaya and the Kudaka Nikaya. So this is what it says, thus have I heard, was just Ananda saying, this is what I heard from the mouth of the Buddha. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the word for the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and Natapindika's Park. And you all know that was one of the places where the Buddha spent most of his life, his teaching career, in the Jeta Grove. It was called the Jeta Grove because it was offered actually used to belong to Prince Jeta, but Natapindika bought it. But Prince Jeta gave the last little piece of the Jeta Grove. And there he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Monks, I shall teach you a discourse on the restraint of all the taints. That's Sabbasava. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the monks replied, the Blessed One said this. And first of all, the idea of this word taints is asava. It can mean one of two things in Pali, which is flowing in or flowing out. And my preference there is flowing out, especially if you're a meditator, you can feel this whenever you're sitting quietly, and the mind flows out to breakfast, to lunch, to a cup of tea, to the past or to the future, to fantasies, to dreams, to plans. You can actually see that process of the mind, which really should be staying inside at home, but it actually flows out. And if you understand that aspect, especially in meditation, you can see it in the rest of your life, always going outwards to things which really don't concern you, which are none of your real business, and that stops you being still. And that whole movement, the outflowing of the mind, is one of the causes for the suffering, which is why when the Buddha teaches the Four Noble Truths, it's usually the truth of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the end of dukkha and the way to the end of dukkha. But he also sometimes replaces that by the asavas. The asavas, the cause of the asavas, the end of the asavas and the way leading to the end of the asavas, which is exactly the same as the Four Noble Truths for suffering. So the idea of asavas, outflowings and suffering, dukkha, sometimes is almost interchangeable. And of course, that asavas, the outflowing, as you can see, it is almost synonymous with craving. Because it's the craving, the wanting, which takes you out from your stillness, from your peace, out into the world of suffering. So if you get a feeling for what the asavas are, the outflowings, the mind not staying at home, but going out to play in the world, to play in the past and the future, to play in the world of thought, it goes outwards rather than going inwards. Now, is that quite clear there? Because it's an important part of this teaching. To get a feeling for what the word asavas are. The word taint doesn't really sort of make much impression on you. But when you learn a bit of Pali, and the asava, you realize it's an outflowing, some movement out from the center, out to the outside. You understand what it means. Okay, so the summary, first of all. Monks, I say that the destruction of these outflowings, I'm going to use the word outflowing now, that the destruction of these outflowings is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. Who knows and sees what? Now obviously knows and sees does not, it's not just means that one sees with the eyes and one sort of knows with one's education. This is just the word which means the deep understanding. So what does they understand? Wise attention and unwise attention. And what wise attention and unwise attention mean in part is yonisa manasikara and at yonisa manasikara. Now wise attention, what does that really mean? Now what is actually wise attention? What is actually the point of wisdom here? And The answer is, when one understands the Pali word is yonisa manasikara. Manasikara is attention, it's work of the mind basically, but attention is fine. But the yonisa comes from the Pali word yoni, which means that the womb of something. So the animals, their womb is called yoni. So yonisa means going to literally the source, the origin, the womb of things. So it's attention which just actually goes, where does this come from? Why does this happen? What's its origin? What's its source? Suffering, but why? Where did it come from? So it's going to the origin of things, the source of things. And in an explanation which I'll always be very grateful to Bhikkhu Bodhi for, he made a very wonderful point which fits in with this idea of going to the origin. That there are two words in Pali which are used as pairs, like night and day, like hot and cold. And those two words, one of them you're very familiar with, is called Dhamma. And the other one you may not be so familiar with is called Atta. Some of you, if you've done some study, know that the Atta is, you see it in the Atta Katha, you know, the words of the Atta. Or sometimes that people would ask the monks, you know, if they were giving, say, asking me, does anything you need for your birthday? And they say, will it be Atta? Will it be of actually consequence, benefit for you in the future? So the word Dhamma and Atta is a pair. And what Dhamma means is this phenomenon looking back to its source, the why, the where from, what did it come from? Where it comes from, that's Dhamma. The Atta is the consequence. Where does this lead to? What's going to happen as a result? That's called the Atta. So these two words in Pali, the Dhamma and the Atta, the source and the consequence, where it's coming from, and the Atta, where it's going to lead to. And that gives you a really good idea of what this word Dhamma truly means. Dhamma is the source of things, it's the why, it's the underlying laws of nature. Now, like in science, gravity, yeah, things, you know, fall down. Yes, sort of the moon and the revolves around the earth, there's an attraction there. We know the phenomena, but why? Where does it come from? And that's Dhamma. Vipaka is more used just with karma. The result of karma. But the word Atta is used very, they say to a monk, is it going to be of good consequence for you, you know, positive consequence, a benefit for you? The Atta is how things pan out, where they lead to. Yes, go on. No, this is Atta. It's a totally different word. So it is. But anyway, the main point of that is giving an understanding of Dhamma. It's where it comes from. So you can see the outflowings, the asavas, they lead to Atta, the consequence of things, where it all leads to. But the yonisa manasikara is actually where does it all come from? Not what you're going to do tomorrow, but where do you come from? Where is this craving coming from? Where is this suffering coming from? So, you know, just the why, the where from. That's Dhamma, and that's found obviously from yonisa manasikara, going to the source of things. So you get angry at somebody. And say, I'm going to really tell him off. I can't do this. This is really wrong. I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm. That's Atta. That's not yonisa manasikara. Yonisa manasikara, the wise attention is, where did this come from? Why am I angry? What is the cause of this? That's yonisa manasikara. See why you have outflowings. Getting that idea? You understand this?
Is that an aspect of outflowing?
It is, yes, where the outflowings go to. Yes, their goal, it's their consequence, their result. So it's cause and effect, basically. Dhamma is the cause, Atta is the effect. So when one attends unwisely, so wise attention, unwise attention. So wise attention is going to the source of things. So why? The unwise attention, what am I going to do? Where's this going to lead to? What am I going to do next? When one attends unwisely, then unarisen outflowings arise and arisen outflowings increase. When one attends wisely, goes to the source of things, then unarisen outflowings, they don't arise. You're going to the inside. And the arisen outflowings are abandoned. Now, you may see straight away, those of you who know a bit about the Dhamma, that there is right effort. You can see the standard definition of right effort in the suttas is whatever is necessary that unarisen, unwholesome states don't arise, and arisen, wholesome states decrease, unarisen sort of and are prevented. So what is it? The four right efforts, you put forth effort so that unarisen unwholesome states don't arise, arisen unwholesome states decrease, unarisen wholesome states arise, and arisen wholesome states continue on and grow. That's called right effort. So you can see here, this is actually talking about right effort. So the unarisen taints, asavas, which are unwholesome, they don't arise, and the arisen ones, they just disappear. So this is actually talking about right effort here. And you see, what is right effort here? It is the wise attention, going to the source of things. So again, as I was mentioning on Wednesday, it's not something you do. It's just something which you see. So stillness is where you get to the source. So this is part of that stillness. You're not doing anything. And naturally, the nature of the mind is always to go inwards. If you leave it alone, do nothing, you tend to go into things. You start doing things, and then you sort of go outwards. So you're getting a feeling for what this all means. So I'll just repeat that first paragraph, because it sets up what this is all about. I say the destruction of these outflowings, so you stay at home, you're still, is for one who knows and sees, not for one who doesn't understand. Understands what? The attention which goes inside, and attention which goes outside. When one attends going outside, the unarisen outflowings, they arise, and the arisen ones increase. But when one attends going inside, the unarisen outflowings, they don't arise, and the arisen ones are all abandoned. Now, the main summary here is there are these outflowings, craving, suffering, you might call it, that should be abandoned by seeing. And this is not so far the eyes, this is by understanding. It's a word called dasana. There are the outflowings that should be abandoned by restraining. There are outflowings that should be abandoned by using. Outflowings that should be abandoned by enduring. Outflowings should be abandoned by avoiding. Outflowings that should be abandoned by removing. The outflowings that should be abandoned by developing. So there are seven different ways here, if I counted them correctly. Now the first one, these are the outflowings to be abandoned by understanding, by insight, if you like. And this is actually referring to, as you'll see later on, I'll just give you the clue here, this is the attainment of being a stream winner, basically seeing non-self. So by seeing the Dhamma, by understanding the Dhamma, becoming a stream winner, these certain asavas are abandoned. What asavas, monks, should be abandoned by insight, by seeing, dasana? Here, monks, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma. Now that's a standard phrase which is referring to those who are not stream winners or on the path of being stream winners, otherwise known in Pali as putuchanas. So on the path of enlightenment, you know, there are these words, the putuchanas, ordinary people, and the aryas, which is one on the path of being a stream winner, and above that. So when you're talking about a Putachana, in the Pali, they have the same phrase all along. An untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma. That's a phrase which is an idiom which always means the Putachanas, the non-Aryans. No, it's not just any bhikkhu. It's very hard to know for certain. But anyone who has either faith in the teachings of the Buddha, especially in the Eightfold Path, so you've got a good understanding and you've got the faith to follow it, or you've got enough wisdom that, yeah, this is the true path and you're really following it. In other words, it's the same as a person who knows this is really worth doing and you're on the path to getting to that goal. So it's usually a combination of wisdom and confidence in this path. And if you've got really a lot of wisdom, lesser confidence, they call that a Dhammanusari, one who follows according to understanding. And if you are a more faith and not so much understanding, you call it a Sadhanusari, one who's going mostly on faith. So of those two, the faith one is very dangerous, because sometimes you have faith in the wrong teachings. So, you know, you don't know what you have faith in. Of course, sometimes people have got so much faith, they'll do anything, they'll follow anything. The example is, I was told that in UK once, I think it was a woman was driving and a nun was in the passenger seat, and the nun said, "Go straight ahead at the roundabout." And the driver had so much faith, they did go straight ahead. You know, right over that central piece. They didn't go round it, they went straight over it. He said, "Well, that's what you said. You said go straight ahead at the roundabout." So that actually happens. So sometimes you have to be very careful. When I say to the driver, you're taking me in somewhere, say, you know, straight ahead of the traffic lights, I usually say, once they're green. So you don't go against the red light. So be careful, because sometimes people have got that much faith, they'll do whatever you say. So be careful. So, of course, that's very great if it's a Buddha teaching you, and then you've got faith in that, you can just 100% trust. But too much faith can be very dangerous. So it's great to have wisdom and understanding. And if that wisdom and understanding is certainly going to lead to seeing non-self, then you are on the path to being a stream winner. But it's very difficult to understand, to know whether you're on the path or not. The attainment of stream winning is very clear. It's an event. So if you're a stream winner, you've attained the fruit of stream winning, you certainly know that. But anyway, this is the difference over here. So the unenlightened, or the non-Aryan, they don't understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, they attend to those things unfit for attention. They don't attend to those things fit for attention. They're going the wrong way. So here, give some examples of things which are unfit for attention, they attend to. There are things such that when they attend to them, the unarisen outflowing of sensuality arises in them, the arisen taint of sensuality increases, the unarisen asava outflowing of being arises in them, the arisen asava of being increases, the unarisen asava of delusion arises in them, and the arisen outflowing of delusion increases. These are the things unfit for attention. In other words, you know, you're using the mind so that these outflowings actually arise and increase. And here, for the first time, we have the three types of outflowings. The outflowings, it's not sensual desire, but that is one of those words which they always, instead of using for five senses, they put the word desire in there. It's for karma, not so much karma raga. So what this really means is you go out to play in the world of the five senses. That's what the sensual desire means. So it is, you can see that, as the mind goes out, you know, for the five senses, to play around with sights and sounds and tastes and smells and physical touches. You go out for that world. And that's the world of Kamaloka, the five senses. Not always for desire, but just actually just to play there. That's the asava for going out in the five senses, the asava for going out for the sake of being, the bhava, bhavasava. Now, of course, that is that outflowing just to show that you exist. And you can see that, especially if you start getting to deep meditation, start to get scared, you're disappearing, your sense of self is vanishing, then the mind will go out, it will bounce out, simply because, you know, you just want to be, you want to exist. And that is a much more refined, the most refined of these outflowings, just to be, to exist. Because when I'm talking to you about this part as a part of disappearing and vanishing, of you just not being there anymore, that is a very scary thing. And the resistance to that is very much this outflowing, which is caused by your wanting to be, wanting to exist. Yes?
Is that pursuing feeling?
It's not a feeling, a perception, anything. Just you don't want to disappear, you're a bit afraid. So that craving to be is the most underlying of the cravings, the underlying one of the outflowings.
So, what is the kind of way of having a relationship, if that arises in the mind, how do you have a relationship to that experience?
The relationship you have with that experience is understanding it's suffering, it sucks. You've been there so many times it stops you enjoying the peace and stillness of meditation. I think that personally, that's what works for me, and I think that's worked for many other people. Okay, it gets those still, and it's scary. You don't want to sort of disappear, but it's just so much fun. And just going out, it just really sucks. It's just terrible. It's just, what am I doing these things for? You're really peaceful, having a great time. You know, if you're just a bit more still, it'd be even better. And just this stupid bower, you know, wanting to be. So sometimes happiness is more important than existing. This is actually what you feel in meditation. You get so deep, you know you can go deep. You know there's more bliss, and it's also profound as well. You get the sense that this is incredibly sort of profound. This is enlightenment stuff. This is really deep. And so, but you know that I have to disappear to get this. And either you're just a sense of happiness and bliss will take you through, or sometimes it's the courageous search for truth. So you wanted to find out what's there, no matter what it costs, even if it costs, you know, your sense of who you are. You just vanish. It's a natural process, yeah. It just will, eventually you have to go there. And one of the ways that somebody asked me recently, that the medieval Christian monks, some of them seem to be able to get into very still states and jhanas. How did they do it? They chose the path of surrender. Surrender of their self to some idea of a god. And you can see that idea of surrender themselves, their ego, their sense of self, would be one of the reasons I think probably they did get into those jhanas, because I can understand that path would go against the bhavasava, the outflowing of being. Because they were willing to non-exist, to sort of let themselves go to some idea of a supreme being.
Yeah. In a sense, even though it's not perfect life views, is an aspect of letting go of that desire to be, is like letting go of that inferior sense of self for a higher sense of self.
That did happen, obviously, with those Christian monks, but they got stuck there. It wasn't really such a good path after all. And you've already done your three questions. but maybe I can give you some more afterwards. But anyway, that's the third of the outblowings. Ignorance, again, that's just too much of an academic's word, ignorance. In other words, if you just get into the on Wikipedia or get into the dictionary, you can let go of your ignorance. It's much deeper than ignorance. The word I like for this awija is like delusion. The reason I like the word delusion, what you're seeing there is real, but you're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. So that's why you're deluded. You're experiencing something, but it's not real. In the same way, the usual example is of a mirage. A mirage, you're not imagining sort of this vision. You're actually, this is something happening in your eyeball, in your sense of sight. You're actually seeing something real. But instead of realizing this is just a reflection on the sky caused by the heat on the road, you can think of it as like a body of water on the road. And that's like the idea of a mirage. So it's real experience, but you're misinterpreting it. That's what delusion is. You're misinterpreting what's out there. So a good example I said the other day, the will. The will is real, you know what it is, you can experience it, but you're misinterpreting it as coming from a sense of self, that it's mine. So this is an example of like the delusion. It's not something which you can see just by being told about it. You have to overcome that asava of delusion in many other ways. So those are the three outflowings, the three types. One which goes out into the sense world, the karma asava, one which goes out into the sense of being, and the one which goes out just out of sheer delusion. So these are the things unfit for attention you attend to, so that those three things increase. And what are the things fit for attention that he does not attend to? There are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen outflowing of the five senses does not arise. The arisen outflowing, which goes into the five sense world, is abandoned. The unarisen outflowing of being does not arise. And the arisen outflowing due to wanting to be is abandoned. The arisen outflowing of delusion does not arise, and the arisen outflowing of delusion is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention he does not attend to. By attending to these things unfit for attention, by not attending to things fit for attention, but unarisen outflowings arise and arisen ones increase. Okay, so this is actually just saying just what the result should be, that these outflowings stop. And this is what they say, if you do the right attention going inwards, all these three types of outflowings stop. Now, this is how. It's not just sort of saying what happens, this is exactly how it. How does you attend unwisely? You say, was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Haven't been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else you're inwardly perplexed about the present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go to? Now, these unattending wisely, sometimes people say, they quote this and say, my goodness, that means that when Ajahn Brahm says you should try and remember your past lives, see, here it says you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't ask, well, was I in the past? What was I not in the past? What was I in the past? That's not what it really means here. This is just a philosophical investigation, and the reason why this is unwise attention is because every one of these propositions and questions there carries the assumption of an I. It is the fact that this assumes there is an atta, there is a self. People just want to know what it was. Now, what was I in the past? Was I not in the past? In other words, this is my first life. What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? Shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? So all of these just carry an assumption So there is a self. You just want to know sort of what you were in the past. And it's that assumption of a self is why this is an unwise attention. And, or else you're inwardly perplexed about the present. You know, this I, which is, you know, am I or am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? And this is all again assuming an I, sort of, that there is an I here. What exactly is this? So this is all assuming a sense of self, which is one of the reasons I think I mentioned even last Wednesday, or sometimes before, I forget when I said what I said, but instead of saying, what am I found it much easier to go inwards and say, what do I take myself to be? So not assuming that I am something and I've just got to find out what that thing is, but actually questioning, you know, this idea of an I. Now, what actually is it? The sense of self, which, you know, you can touch, you can sort of know. What actually is it? That's going inwards. But if you just say, this I, no, it doesn't exist. There is a sense of I there. What exactly is it? Not denying it, because that's denying that sense of self. It's like, am I not? It's like saying that, you know, there is no will. So there is will. But what actually is it? So that's actually what we mean by wise attention. That's one way of doing it, being still, because there's an old exercise which I do. I do it again, I haven't done it for some of you. I hold something up and I ask, what is it? What is it? Come on, play with me. Yeah, what else is it? Yeah, what else? Give me more information. Yeah, keep on going. What else? Can you tell me about this? That's not condensed milk, unfortunately. What are you seeing? Describe it to me. Yeah, keep on going. What else can you see? Yeah, what else? Okay, it's enough now, because my arm's getting tired. Because what happens is, the longer you look, the more you see. Usually, if I hold it up, you just say, cup. And you think you're finished with it. Which means you don't look any longer. Cup, you're finished, you know it. Because when I pressed you, it's much more than a cup. And the longer you look, the more you see. And that's one of the reasons why people don't get understanding or insight, because they look at someone, it's Danny. It's Matt. It's Nicholas. It's the Buddha. You think you know these things. Because you look so superficially. And you go on to the next thing too quickly. When you stay with something, the longer you look, the more you see. You tend to go into it. You have to be still to rest your attention on something and don't move. If you see something and you think, oh, this is the mind, this is will, don't do that. It's just a name. Stop and look deeper. And the longer you look, the more you'll see. That's why stillness is another reason why stillness is essential for insight. Just look at something, flower, roof, hot, cold. It's not hot, cold. It's much deeper than that. So stay with the feeling of heat. The longer you experience it, the more you see into it. That's a simile of looking at a cup. So this is actually... Oh, you've got something, Daniel. Yeah.
So their method of surrendering
themselves,
so they would, because it's not a view that they're in the higher self, but they don't really surrender themselves, because
they surrender some of themselves.
But in a Buddhist perspective, they don't lose their sense of self.
But one of the things they do surrender is their will. Not totally, but they do lose their will. Mm-hmm. They give their will to God.
They still have the sense of
self, of a mind, of a consciousness, by letting go of the will. They just give themselves up to God. God, you just do it.
So
which is, if you believe in that God, it would make it much easier to get into jhana.
So the phrase surrendering themselves.
It's surrendering the will. Yeah, surrendering the will.
Right, because they don't get that
indeed, yeah. So I can actually understand just the path which they would follow and just how it could be effective. They could get that far. Obviously, they get into a block, they can't go further. But certainly, the surrendering of their will is a good way of like overcoming the doer, which means that they get still. See how that happens. But anyway, this is a turning unwise. It doesn't go to the source of the matter. It misses the I. It assumes the I is existing instead of saying, what is this thing I take to be an I? And because of this, attending unwisely, they say one of six views arises in them. The view that the self exists for me. In other words, I do have a self, as true and established. Or the view that no self exists for me arises in them as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with self arises in them as true and established. Or the view I perceive not self with self arises in them as true and established. Or the view I perceive self with no self arises in them as true and established. Or else you have some such view as this: it is the self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad action. But the self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. So these are those six wrong views here. The first, that self exists for me. The word exists would be much better translated as persists for me. So in other words, persists means it keeps on going on forever and ever. So yeah, there is a self, and it's there for me forever.
Permanent
self, yeah. And the next view, the self, no self exists for me. That's not the teaching of the Buddha, of Anatta. That's the teaching of that the self does not persist. In other words, you have a self. By the time of your death, that's it, finished, gone, poof. So, again, the Pali, the idiom, is not so clear when it's translated like that. If you say, no self persists for me, it means there is a self for me, there is a self there, implied, but it doesn't go on past the end of this particular life. So that's why the first view is like called the eternalist view, that you're there forever, never, never. The second one is just the materialist view. Yeah, you've got a self now, a soul, but the time of death is gone. The next three are perceive a self with the self, so there is a self there, you can see the self with yourself, or that there is a self, but you can't really see it, you can just see what's not self, or that you can perceive a self but with a not self. And the one which is missing of the four combinations is the right one: you perceive not self with a not self. That's the Buddha's one. So you see the four combinations there. I did maths at school and university, so you know what combinations are all about. Self, not self, so you perceive a self with a not self, you perceive a not self with a self, or not self with a not self. And the one which is missing is the right one. But if you're not a philosopher, you're just an ordinary Joe, then, I don't mean Joanne, I mean just an ordinary Joe, anybody, it is the last one which is the most common of those six. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels. Now the speaker is not just with the mouth, it's with the mind. It's myself and mine which is the doer. The speaker is the one which organizes things and which tells you what to do. That inner speech and outer speech. So that's the self which speaks, which does things. And it's that self which feels. So the active part of you and the passive part which receives things. So that's, for me, the doer and the knower. It's the self which is the doer, the speaker. It's the self which is the knower. which experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. But this self, this knower and doer, is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. That's the most common. But you are the one who speaks. Did you say anything a minute ago, Nicholas? Not really. Very good. Pass the test. So it's not you who spoke. So you can have another three. It's not you who felt anything. So you don't have to worry about things. So they call this, and this is the Buddha saying, that these views, this speculative view, speculative because it's not real, is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. It's the Buddha actually using a lot of lovely similes, the thicket of views. Because a thicket is like a bush, it's just so hard to get the way through it. It's just like this thick jungle, you just have to, with a machete, just hack your way through, and you can only make maybe 1 kilometer a day if you're lucky. And the wilderness of views, because there's no joy, there's no sustenance there. The contortion of views, which is my favourite one there, because when you're contorting, you just bend all different ways to try and prove this wrong idea. The vacillation of views, the vacillation means you don't do anything. I mean, basically, you just, because you think you're going to be there forever, you don't really, take responsibility to do what's right, to practice, whatever. And of course, the fetter of views. And a fetter is that thing which they tie prisoners to. They've got fetters, the ball and chains, the ankle fetters. This is what stops people from moving forward. So fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person is not free from birth, aging and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. He's not freed from dukkha. And straight away you're seeing here that because of these views of self, that's why you can never get free of suffering. And where do these views of self come from? It's because one looked unwisely. Basically one asked the wrong questions, one looked in the wrong place. One had unwise attention. And now what is? The well-taught noble disciple has regard for noble ones, is skilled and discipled, disciplined in their Dharma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their Dharma, in other words, the one on the path of being a stream winner, understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, he attends to those things fit for attention. So what are the things unfit for attention is to not attend to? The same as before, there are things such when you attend to them, the unarisen outflowings of sensuality, the five senses, being and delusion arise, and those arisen outflowings of the five sense world, being and delusion increases. Those are the things unfit for attention, does not attend to. And what are the things fit for attention you attend to? They are things such that when you attend to them, the unarisen outflowing of the five sense world, being and delusion does not arise, and those outflowings arisen get abandoned. Those are the things fit for attention that you attend to. And straight away you see that in Pali there's a huge amount of repetition. And one of the reasons is repetition in Pali is because by saying things 3 or 4 or 5 times, there's a good chance that people might remember them. Remember, this was not written down in words, in books. You just heard it from the teacher. You heard it once. If you just heard it once, you probably forget it. So by repetition and repetition and repetition, it's more likely to get in. So this was originally an oral teaching, not written down in books, which is why there's so much repetition. And it's how do you attend wisely? You attend wisely that this is suffering, this is dukkha. Not this is self, this is suffering. This is the origin, where it comes from. Why is there suffering? And this is the cessation of suffering. And this is the way leading to cessation of suffering. When you turn wise in this way, then the three fetters are abandoned in them. Personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. In other words, one is a spree winner. These are called the outflowings that should be abandoned by seeing, by insight. Now, of course, how does one do this? So, as I've taught before, when you are meditating, if you're having a hard time, this is suffering. To know it. And then you say, why? The cause of suffering. Why are you having a hard time? Why aren't you peaceful? Why aren't you enjoying today? And of course, what's the reason why? Craving. That's the cause of suffering, the second noble truth, which is why I've taught people. If you're meditating and you are getting into trouble, you're not having a good time, you're getting frustrated, what should you do? Wise attention, this is suffering. Cause of suffering. You've been craving, baby. That's why you're suffering. So don't just sit there and try harder. If you're having a hard time meditating, don't just come and see me and say, Ajahn Brahm, I'm having a difficult time meditating. What should I do? No, you're suffering. It's because you've been craving. So you're learning the first and second noble truths. But then you have a beautiful meditation. No suffering, peaceful, delightful. That's getting close to the third noble truth. Why? Because you've abandoned craving. So when you're having a nice meditation, use wise attention. It's because you haven't been craving. Which is why some time ago I said there are two types of meditation. Second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Second noble truth meditation is suffering. When am I going to finish this meditation? It's just terrible. What can I do? I want to do something else. I want to read a book. I want to go out somewhere. I want to do something because you're suffering. If your meditation is not blissful, it means you've just been doing second noble truth meditation. Craving. Wanting something. That's why you suffer. So, if whenever you're meditating, if you're suffering, it's because you've been craving. Been wanting something. That's why the meditation doesn't bite, where it's not peaceful, where it's not happy. That's second noble truth. That's wise attention. And when you're having a beautiful meditation, peaceful meditation, why? If you're doing third noble truth meditation, it's peaceful, ending suffering, it means you've been letting go, you've been doing no craving. So there are two types of meditation, second noble truth and third noble truth meditation. So know which one you're doing. If it's peaceful, that's called third noble truth meditation. You'll be letting go. Learn from that. If you're having a hard time, getting frustrated, getting bored, you've been wanting something. Learn from that. That's called wise attention. Instead of trying to stop it and fight it, you learn from it. You go to why. You're suffering. Why am I suffering? You're peaceful. Why am I peaceful? That's called insight, going in. So when you attend wise in such a way, three fetters are abandoned. These are the ten fetters of Sangyojanas. There are personality view, which is a big thing. And the personality view is that somewhere in here there's a self, there's a me. In particular, the five khandhas, the body, the feelings, the perceptions, the mental formations and consciousness. You think that somehow or other one of these is me, or they contain a me, or that there's a me in there that controls all these things, and somehow there's a self in there, with any of the five khandhas. Any of the five khandhas. So it's very easy to see this body is not yours. Ha 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 ha. But you think you own your body, which is just as good, just as much as saying it's me. Me and mine. So the body, but your feelings, the happiness and suffering of life. Is that you? Do you own it? Well, you realize you don't own it, so it's none of my business anymore. So having a good time, having a bad time, it's nothing to do with me. You're suffering, you're blissed out, nothing to do with me. It's not mine. Anyway, you know, just you can get happiness, you can get suffering, just two come together. Nor your perceptions, you know, about who's a really good guy, who's really stupid, who's an arahat, who's a non-returner, who's smart, who's stupid. It's just perception, nothing to do with me, so just the mind doing its thing. Don't trust in it. And your mental formations. So what's the biggest thing of the sankharas? Is chedana, your will. Nothing to do with me. So the advanced personality view is knowing that the will doesn't come from a me, it's not mine. It doesn't originate from the essential Ajahn Brahm. That's why I take no responsibility for what I do in this monastery or for what I teach. Nothing to do with me. And lastly, consciousness. Nothing to do with me. Any of the six consciousnesses. Seeing conscious, hearing conscious, smelling, tasting, touching, even mind consciousness. Vijitta. Nothing to do with me. That's called abandoning personality view. Abandoning the idea that somewhere there is an abiding self. And doubt is, you know, not understanding exactly what we're doing here. And of course, personality view, that's the main one to overcome. Once you see that, it's quite clear about what the path is and what you have to do. And the adherence to rules and observances, that is the idea that by keeping these rules and observances, that's all you need to do, and by doing that, you're going to actually become enlightened. It's not to say that one should abandon these rules and observances, but actually to see them for what they're really worth. They are a vehicle, they are a raft to cross over the water, and they need to be abandoned, but not until you've got across the water. You don't jump off the boat in midstream. So keep all these rules, keep all of your observances and all the jobs you have to do. And anyway, when you do become enlightened, they just become second nature, but they're not real rules and observances, they're just the nature of what you have to do. So those are the three fetters.
Does it scream if you have any doubts anymore?
Not about the Dhamma. Sure they have it for the doubts about whether your aircraft is going to leave on time. They have doubts about sort of, you know, whether you're going to be able to pay the bills, whether who's going to win the next election. No doubt about the Dhamma. That's one of the reasons, actually, they say that a stream enterer can't disrobe. Because they've got no doubts anymore about the Dhamma. It's a very good point.
He can't.
A stream enterer, because they know exactly what they should do. No doubts anymore. Interesting point. Oh, no, if they're a layperson, yeah, it can be a stream enterer, but if they're already a monk, if you're already in the Sangha, then you can't sort of get out. No point to it anymore. Yes, John? I'll sorry, hand. Okay. That's the big one of this sutta. These are the outflowings which are abandoned by this insight of being a stream winner. So of course they're not totally abandoned. You still sort of got work to do, but a lot of that is abandoned. So not all the outflows, but a huge amount of them is abandoned by your insight. So why go out into the five sense world anymore? Or even the outflowing of existing, of being, is restricted, and the outflowing of delusion is restricted. So much of the reason why you go out into the world is actually taken away. Which means already by that insight it's much easier to keep still. And just to keep simple. All simplicity is just not out going out and engaging in the world. But it's hard to be simple, isn't it? Simply because, you know, just the mind just goes out there. It's like both thinking and gets caught up in things. But when you have that insight, the mind likes to stay at home more. So the outflowings are just being restricted by insight, by seeing. Yes?
What is actually the vehicle of, like, those asanas? What is the thing that goes out?
What goes out is just the mental process, especially the Chaitanya, pushes you out. The craving pushes you out. You can see it as a stream of consciousness. That's just one way of looking at it. It just goes out into the world.
And when poison is there, that vehicle doesn't exist anymore? Or?
It's not the vehicle, but the incentive to go and play anymore. Why go out and play in that world? Just, so would you like to join the army and go to Afghanistan and fight for freedom? It'd be crazy to do something like that. Just that sort of type of incentive is just abandoned in you. We'd like to come become rich. We'd like to become like Roger Federer, the champion tennis player of Switzerland. Of course, you know, maybe when you were young you wanted to, but what do you want to do that for? So many of those incentives, just through insight, through wisdom, get abandoned. With more wisdom, more of those incentives get abandoned, so the mind doesn't go out into that world anymore. Don't want to play there anymore.
So, but is seeing yourself that just needs more than just to I think it also needs this sense of awareness what's going on.
Yeah, that particular dasana is actually seeing especially the non-self. Going deep inside, saying, what do I think? Because that's what the whole point about here is you know, saying, you know, what is this thing, you know, which is consciousness? What is this thing which is called will? What is this body?
In meditation, you just have to be aware of what's going on, actually.
If you're just aware, then again,
if you get caught up, then you just get carried away.
You get carried away. If you're just aware, you become still. When you get still, things disappear. That's right, you get some understanding like the simile of the tadpole and the frog. When the frog's outside of the lake and the lake's disappeared, then the frog knows what the lake was.
So the next time the similar the same situation occurs, then you just know, was. So I know what to do.
You know what to do, and you know this has nothing to do with me. You know what water is, you know what will is, you know what consciousness is, you know what body is.
So it's close connected to mindfulness.
It is the mindfulness which is also remembers. Remember that word mindfulness, sati, is a combination of the awareness and also the memory. The Sanskrit smriti, which is the not just being aware, but knowing what one is aware of. That's why usually in Pali, usually it's always with sampajanya, sati sampajanya, awareness and knowing. For many people are aware, you ask sort of a tightrope walker is fully aware, a burglar is incredibly aware, but they're not very wise. Okay. Yes? I think what you're asking there is just, you know, during a jhana there is all the data there, when you come out afterwards there's the opportunity there, but there's also opportunities afterwards. Now listening to a great teaching of the Buddha, that's what that was. Now I understand it. It gives you the framework to understand. Exactly, yeah. It gets some understanding of what it means.
That time of the discourse, they could abandon.
I think what is actually happening, say in Sanatana, you're experiencing the state where much of what you thought to be a self has disappeared and vanished. But of course, that during that experience, the mind is too still. So you've just got an experience, you've got a data. You haven't really processed it yet. And to process that, as they say these days, and to really understand it, for that to get deep inside, maybe take some time. And sometimes what is necessary is just to understand what the hell was that. And to get some understanding, and you get a really nice teaching of the Buddha which puts it into perspective, gives you a framework to understand it. Ah, now I know what that is. Yes, that means. Obvious. Yes, yeah, no self. So jhana together with Dhamma.
Yeah, and does this happen like
right
after?
Okay, right after or later on. Sometime later. Yeah, can do, yeah, that's one way. But in the suttas, whenever they say, in the suttas, when they say the person became a stream winner, the way of Pali is that it means that they became one on the path to being a stream winner. They don't make too much of a distinction between one on the path and one who's actually there, simply because that once you're on the path, you have to reach the goal. There's no turning back. So, in the same way that I've said that in the movies I used to see when I was a kid, if someone had crossed the mafia boss, they would say, oh, you're dead. And it didn't mean they were dead, because they were still alive. It meant that your death was certain. And that's why they said, you're dead, Dalia. But that's similar in Pali, because they say, you're a stream winner. You're not yet, but your stream winning is certain. You're on the path. Yes?
After the being comes out of jhana and their functioning starts to build again, is the switching of the mode of perception from the jhana to passing through, does that give the data to infer that the realm of the mind as well is not permanent?
It can do, it can give you the inference that the consciousness is not permanent, it's changing. And so it's, you know, it's liable to vanish as well as the body has vanished, as well as the will has vanished. So it's possible to do that.
So this is a big influence that there's no permanent state in the aggregate. How does that, is it just a natural power of mind to see that?
No, it's not the natural power of the mind to see that. You do need some help from the teachings of another Aryan to be able to listen to the suttas of the Buddha. And you see this, and that gives you a framework so that you can understand the experiences you've had. You need the experiences and you need the framework to explain what the experience was and how it fits together. And then the light bulb turns on. Ah. That's what it means.
So there's an aspect of the experience that powers the insight.
That's part of it. The old simile that you do need the flashlight as well as the map to find the treasure. The flashlight is the jhana, the map is the Dhamma, what you're hearing here. Okay, yes, yeah. Sampajanya. Okay, yeah. Sampajanya, yeah. Sampajanya literally means with wisdom. With panya. It is the understanding which is, when you're mindful, it's with the wisdom. What does this really mean? It's not just being aware, but understanding what you're doing, what it means, where it comes from. So it's understanding, just not being aware, but understanding what's happening, what you're supposed to be doing, what this really means, its consequences. So you can be very aware that sort of the hoard is burning down, I'm fully aware, but then, you know, you're not wise enough to run out. Or another simile, which is one of my favourite similes, is a bit sort of naughty and critical, but it's a simile of the guard who is left at the mansion while the owner of the mansion comes and listens to a talk at Bamaloka Buddhist Centre. And before she leaves, she tells the guard, please be careful, there are many burglars around, so I want you to be really mindful. And the guard said, yes ma'am, I will be mindful. And so she listens to a nice talk. When she goes home, she found her house has been ransacked by the burglars. And she tells the guard, look, I told you to be mindful. He said, madam, I was mindful. I saw burglars going in. I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them coming out again with the safe. I said, safe going out, safe going out, safe going out. I saw them going inside your house again. I was very mindful. I watched them go in. I saw everything, and I saw them taking your jewellery out. I noted, jewellery going out, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I was mindful, madam. So that was mindfulness without Sampajanya. So the Sampajanya is you ring the police, or you stop the burglars, you lock the door. So it's with wisdom. It's not just being mindful. It's knowing what you should be doing as well. No, because a lot of the mindfulness does not come from trying.
Yeah.
I've seen people do that for years, and they were just faking the mindfulness, trying to be mindful, trying to be mindful, and they were just tensing up all the time. So you allow it just to happen naturally. The mindfulness arises particularly when the five hindrances go. So when you let go of all the five hindrances, a sensory desire, you know, or ill will, you know, it's just not really seeing what's going on, but seeing what you want to see, or just being in denial for what's really there. So that's obviously not really aware of what's happening. And then restlessness, you know, you're just not here long enough to be mindful. You're just wandering all over the place. Or dullness, you know, it's obviously not mindful. And last one, doubt, you know, you're just, what's going on? It's a different type of restlessness. So when those five hindrances are there, that means you're not mindful. So after those five hindrances are gone, the mindfulness happens naturally. Which is why a lot of times I've said that the path of meditation gives you mindfulness, power mindfulness, and super power mindfulness. You know you've got that power mindfulness and super power mindfulness when you're incredibly aware. So you know, look at the carpet, and it's beautiful. You go outside, the stars, incredible. As if just, you know, your awareness has just gone up a few notches. And that's natural for when you get some nice meditation going. So you'll find when the meditation gets strong, your mindfulness increases. That's how you create mindfulness. And for the wisdom part of it, that's my job, the job of this book's, to actually, to, for you to understand what it really means. Yeah. Yeah. Satisampajanya. I think
it helps kind of boost the
mindfulness. Yeah, I think that was the Satisampajanya. That was a nutriment of Satisampajanya, not just Sati. So it's more the wisdom part of it. But the mindfulness is very much sort of, you can see that in your own experience. The mindfulness is very much empowered by meditation which abandons the five hindrances. Okay, now the outflowings to be abandoned by restraining. So we've only got one, we've got another six to go yet. The next ones are quite easy though. What outflowings, monk, should be abandoned by restraining? Here, a monk reflecting wisely abides with the eye faculty restraints. This eye faculty restrained. While outflowings, vexation and fever, that's ill will and desire, might arise in one who abides with the eye faculty unrestrained, there are no outflowings, I call it ill will or desire in one who abides with the eye faculty restrained. So reflecting wisely, you abide with the ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, body faculty, mind faculty restrained. While outflowings, ill will and desire might arise in one who abides with the faculties unrestrained, there are no outflowings, ill will or craving in one who abides with the faculties restrained. These are called the outflowings that should be abandoned by restraining. So what that means is, you know, you sort of see, all you guys, young men, see this beautiful girl come into the monastery. Really sort of a hot girl. And you sort of go out to her. Of course, what's going to happen? Your eyes are not restrained. Everything else is not restrained. Your speech is not restrained. And that really gets to you afterwards. I will always remember this young monk, the youngest monk we've ever had here. You know, Jake, his name was, with Anenja, for those of you who remember him. And you know, he was really trying his best. But he said he just came straight out of a nightclub into this monastery, basically. And it was just, his karma was such that we had our Katina day, and it was this couple of floozies, and they really were floozies. They were dressed as if they'd just come out of a nightclub. And they saw all these cars just parked outside, they just decided to come and have a look. And of course, who did they go to straight away? To this poor Anenja. And I had to rescue him. I saw him, these two, you know, young floozies were just talking to him. And so I talked to them to rescue him. And he said he just had to go back to his hut and sit down for 2 hours. It was just so much fever. The poor guy, he's just a young man, that's what happened. And that happens to like girls as well, the other way around. So there's, you know, sometimes these things, yeah, they're good to look at, but they can actually spin you out for hours or days afterwards. Or the other one, you know, you find somebody upsets you. You know, they do something wrong, you find going into the kitchen in the evening and they take a sandwich or they take some milk or something. Stupid, they can't do that. And you can spin out for days on that. And yet that's unrestrained. In other words, if you restrain your senses, then you don't get vexation. But basically it's none of your business. Everyone, you all know the rules here. You keep them, you don't keep them, that's your business. Now you're not prison guards. This is not sort of a Stalag camp like in the Second World War. This is not sort of, you know, where we're going to beat you if you sort of break a rule. This is the total honor system. If you break a rule, it's your business. It's your karma. You're going to suffer. So you can keep restraint of the senses. In fact, I don't know if anybody my age, maybe John Fisher, maybe. There used to be one of my favourite shows on TV was Hogan's Heroes. It was about this prisoner of war camp in the Second World War. And my favourite character, this is my mentor, the sort of person I live up to as an abbot of a monastery. It was, what was his name again now? Sorry? Schultz, that's right. Schultz was a prison guard. Whenever he saw these American prisoners of war up to no good, you know, going to the pub or doing all sorts of stuff, he'd put his hand over his eyes and say, I see nothing, I see nothing, I see nothing. That's called sense restraint. That's what I do. Whatever you guys get up to, I see nothing, I see nothing, I see nothing. So if you see any of your friends do bad things, I see nothing, I see nothing. So you know, keep it for yourself. It's not your job. That's right, yeah. Okay, that's sense restraint, sort of. But anyway, you know what it's talking about. That's sense restraint. And that's one way of abandoning these outflowings of the mind. Just keep, you know, your eyes down. Or if you do see something you like, say you see food, and if you're having trouble with the food in this monastery, because it's very delicious food in this monastery, you can see, to get restraint in the food, you see all that food there, and that's what I want, this is what I want, this is what I want. Remember that all that food you put in the mouth, when it comes out the other end, it's shit. Where did that shit come from? It was in the food. It was in there somewhere, because it did come from nowhere. So in your bowl there, there's shit in there, but it's all covered up with this other stuff. So what the body does, it takes out the good stuff, all the nutrients and the proteins and stuff, whatever else, the carbohydrates, And it's sort of, you know, the other stuff which is left is the shit. So when you're bored, that's actually shit there. It's in there somewhere. So you look for that, and then that's just beautiful lasagna or that beautiful salad. There's shit there somewhere. It's just covered up with this nice green and red tomatoes or whatever. But it's shit, really. It has to be. It doesn't come from nowhere. So you're actually eating shit plus something else. So looking at it that way, that's called sense restraint, because after a while you don't really want to eat very much. So what it's actually doing, it's just using a way so that you're more restrained, so you don't sort of look at just the beautiful part of things.
So that's the deception, is it just to support balance
and happiness? Balance, yes.
Without being a master of willingness.
That's right, yeah, because otherwise you get into vexation. So just restrain things a bit. Okay, tends to be abandoned by using. What outflowings might you be abandoned by using? Here, monks, reflecting wisely, uses the robe. So this is the four requisites, what you have to use. So you use your clothes, only for protection from cold, from protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, creeping things, only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. So that's what you wear clothes for. So you don't have Gucci robes, you don't have designer Anagarika wear. You just use these things just for those purposes. And that means you're actually abandoning those outflows. Why do people actually want to wear sort of fashionable stuff? You know, or sort of designer labels. That should be crazy stuff to do that. So when you're using things, you have to use robes or clothes. This is the purpose. And the same with alms food. Reflecting wisely, you use alms food not for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for any discomfort of being hungry, and for assisting the holy life, considering thus, I shall terminate all feelings of hunger or weakness without arising new feelings of being stuffed, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So this is actually, for those of you upstairs, you know, when before I ring the bell, that's why I recite that to myself all the time. That's the reflection I do before I have my meal. Reflecting wisely, I use my alms food not for amusements, not for fun or intoxication, not for physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting the holy life, considering thus I shall end all feelings of hunger without arising new feelings of overeating. That way I should be healthy and blameless and should live in comfort. So that's we use our food that way. Reflecting wisely, you use your resting place, your room, only for protection from cold, from heat, from protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun and creeping things, only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate and for enjoying solitude. I love that one at the end. Because that's why we have our rooms here, for solitude. That's why we try and, for the monks in brown, we try and have our own little rooms so we can have solitude. That's why in the Anagarika block, which I designed, it's so you can't see each other. It's why the Ajahn Brahmani just put these extra walls in the guest rooms so that you can't sort of hear each other. So we try and have solitude. That's the purpose of these rooms. So don't go right inviting everybody in. Hey, come around for tea this afternoon. You know, I've got some special coffee, guys. Please come around. No, it's not for the purpose of entertaining. It's the purpose of solitude. And reflecting wisely, you use the medicinal requisites, tea and coffee, whatever, only for protection from arisen afflicted feelings and for the benefit of good health. So while outflowings, vexation and craving fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no outflowings, vexation, or desire in one who uses them thus. These are called the outflowings that should be abandoned by using. And by enduring, what outflowings monk should be abandoned by enduring? Here a monk reflecting wisely bears cold and heat. So it doesn't matter how much you do, you're always going to feel some cold sometimes or too hot. So you just bear it, as long as it's not going to be dangerous for you. Hunger and thirst. And contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun and creeping things. But also, this is a great part, you endure ill-spoken, unwelcome words. So someone calls you a bloody idiot. you just endure it. Fair enough. I've heard worse. So just don't get upset. That's an outflow to be endured, sorry, to be overcome by enduring it. Or arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and medicine to life. If you can get some medicine, fine, but if you can't, sometimes you just have to endure. Be patient. While outflowing vexation and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no outflowing vexation or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. So in other words, no vexation. Someone calls you an idiot or stupid. That's their problem. It says much more about them than it ever says about you. And that way we can be peaceful. But outflowing to be abandoned by avoiding. Now sometimes, this is what one should be doing, sometimes we don't just endure, sometimes we do avoid. So if someone is getting angry at you in the kitchen or whatever, sometimes it's not a good idea just to endure there, just walk away. Sometimes that's a nice thing to do. Especially if they get hold of the knife or the meat cleaver and run after you, it's good to avoid. Run away. So what outflowings monk should be abandoned by avoiding? Here, monk reflecting wisely avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild kangaroo. No, that's not down there. So a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. In other words, sometimes people think, oh, monk should have no craving, no desire. So if they're walking towards a sewer, there's no walk through it, it's only a sewer. No, to avoid it, obviously. Reflecting wisely, avoid sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts. Now, who knows what unsuitable seats and unsuitable resorts are? So if a monk is alone with a woman, that's unsuitable. If a man is, even a woman here, is alone with a man, that can be unsuitable. Unsuitable resorts is going to the pub or to the casino. And other such stuff. So I've managed to avoid that, but sometimes got very close. I was once giving a talk in Pinjarra to the Rotary Club. And these Rotary Clubs, they always meet in the pub. But it's usually they've got a back door, so it's in the back of the pub where they have all these meeting rooms. But in the Pinjarra Hotel, they said, no, there's no back door. The only way to the meeting room is actually going right through the bar. And unfortunately, the guy, the Anagarika, who dropped me off, they were going out doing something else. So they dropped me off there. They're going to pick me up a couple of hours later. So you should never do that, because sometimes the monk gets in big trouble. So there I was outside the pub. And not knowing what to do. And I asked the guy, so it's just at the end of the pub. So I thought, okay, this is it. So I made a beeline. I head down, walked as fast as I could to get to the room at the back. But of course, it always happens. I was almost past the bar, and someone grabbed me by the shoulder. Ajahn Brahm, what are you drinking? I said, I'll have an orange juice, but in the room over there, leave me alone. So that's unsuitable resort. The reason is, obviously, because, yeah, I know I'm a good monk, you know, I don't drink alcohol, but people see you going into the pub. And they're getting a glass of orange juice, or no, worse, apple juice. They said, that's wine, that's whiskey, because it looks exactly the same as whiskey, and it's, you know, the same colour. So that's where you've got to be very careful, where you end up at. That's called wrong resort. So try and avoid that. Associating with bad friends, since if we're to do so, wise companions of the whole life must suspect him of evil conduct. So you try and avoid such things if you possibly can. So while outflowings, vexation and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no outflowings, vexation and fever in one who avoids them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. Now the outflowings to be abandoned by removing. What monks should be abandoned by removing? And this is a powerful thing. Here, monks, reflecting wisely, does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. You abandon it, remove it, does away with it, annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will. Doesn't tolerate an arisen thought of cruelty. You do not tolerate arisen evil unwholesome states. You ban them, remove them, does away with them, and annihilates them. Now those are the thoughts called Michha Sankapa, the wrong sort of wrong thoughts or wrong intentions. So it's sensuality, ill will and cruelty. Those are the three wrong sankapas, Michha Sankapas. Was it Karma Sankapa, Vyapada Sankapa, and Hingsaka Sankapa? Aha! Very easy, you do the opposite. So by not tolerate it, if you just try and get rid of it with ill will, it just gets worse because you get another arisen thought of ill will. That's what you're supposed to be getting rid of. Thoughts of ill will. So you do that with this opposite. So with sensuality, with renunciation, letting go, making peace, giving away, not wanting anything. And with ill will, how do you overcome ill will? Metta, yeah, with loving kindness, be kind. So you have a thought of ill will, and if you have ill will towards ill will, you know where that leads. You've done it many times. I shouldn't have ill will, and now you've got double ill will. So I've got ill will, okay, just I'm a human being, it's fine, never mind, it's okay, you can have ill will, you're alright, Ajahn Brahm. And of course that's the way ill will goes. So if you say, I shouldn't have ill will, I'm a monk, I've been an abbot for so many years, I'm not supposed to have ill will, of course then it gets much worse. So a lot of time you have ill will, just be kind to it. And then you understand that great simile and open the door of the heart of the demon who came into the emperor's palace. You know that one, if you don't know it, it's in there, open the door of your heart, in the library. Anger eating demons, get out of here, you don't belong. And the demon gets bigger and uglier and much worse. When a demon comes into your mind, oh welcome, thank you for coming in. And then the demon gets much less.
It seems that thinking is just a small aspect of the mind. What is its role? What is it that you use without
it in your control? Well, you have to ask a question. When it's a thinking which ends thinking, rather than a thought which makes more thought. And lastly of all, the outflow to be abandoned by developing. Now, we started off with the outflowings which make you stream winner. And these are also the ones which really help you as your practice. But the last one is the one which makes you an arahat. And developing means bhavana. Developing. What outflowings monks should be abandoned by developing? Here, a monk, nun, layperson, reflecting wisely develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. Develops the investigation of states enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the stillness enlightenment factor, the equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and ripens in relinquishing. That is called the Bojangas, the seven enlightenment factors. And hopefully you know those pretty well. The mindfulness, the investigation of Dhammas, the rapture, so the energy. Energy, the virya, is not just energy, it's the heroic energy. I was mentioning that to someone recently. The virya comes from vira, which is the hero. And so it's heroic energy. Why do you call someone a hero? Because they're willing to sacrifice their very life for the country, for whatever. So it's that heroic aspect of energy, the ability to sacrifice, to let go, to abandon everything. That's the energy which we really mean here. So it is the investigation of Dhammas, the heroic energy, the rapture. This is the joy. Remember, these, you're supposed to develop joy and happiness. The tranquility enlightenment factor. You're supposed to develop stillness. Don't think you're going to get attached to it. You're supposed to develop this. And the stillness, the samadhi enlightenment factor, and the equanimity enlightenment factor. And each one of these is supported by seclusion. That's why you have your own rooms. Even in Jhana Grove, every room has its own ensuite, so you don't have to go and meet everybody to go to the toilet even. You've got your own toilet, it gives you more seclusion. And seclusion is really important, you know, for developing these things. Dispassion and cessation, which ripens in letting go. So while the outflowings, vexation and fever, might arise in one who does not develop these enlightenment factors, there are no outflowings, vexation and fever, one who develops them. These are called the outflowings which should be abandoned by developing, and those are the big ones. Monks, when for a monk or a nun, a lay person, the asavas that should be abandoned by seeing have been by insight, have been abandoned by insight. For those abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining. Those that should be abandoned by using have been abandoned by using. Those that should be abandoned by enduring have been abandoned by enduring. Those that should be abandoned by avoiding have been abandoned by avoiding. When those that should be abandoned by removing have been abandoned by removing. And when those that should be abandoned by developing have been abandoned by developing, then they are called the monk, the nun, the lay person who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the asuras. They have severed craving. There's no outflowings anymore. No craving, can't move. Flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, they have made an end of suffering. What does it mean by conceit? That's a special word. It means it's the I am. There are three conceits. You know what the three conceits are? I am better. I'm the best Anagarika in the whole monastery. That's one conceit. The other conceit, I am worse. I'm the most hopeless lay person who's ever come to Bodhinyana Monastery. I don't know why Ajahn Brahman, the monks, put up with me. I'm just terrible. I can't meditate. I'm just totally useless. That is also conceit. And the worst conceit of all, I am the same. We're all equal. That's being very conceited. You're not equal. You're not the same. You're not better. You're not worse. You're nothing. So I've had all conceits. Isn't it nice not to judge? Because even saying the same is judging. No judging at all. Made an end of dukkha. That's what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that is a sample of just these teachings. And it can be incredibly deep, some of these teachings. That's a very nice sutta there. Just basically about the practice and how to become enlightened. It's all there for you. Any questions? Okay, thank you for enjoying. Now you can avoid by leaving, by removing yourself, and by going back and doing some more developing. So, before we go, the next Saturday evening, it's the new moon night, so the monks will be in here doing the Patimokkha. So the next sutta class will be on Friday, next Friday, so just the day before. And then we'll be doing the sutta, the heirs to the Dhamma. Again, it's a very nice one. So I'll be saying quite a few things about that, some which maybe you may not like. But something which is very true, heirs to the Dhamma, is coming next. Yeah. Yeah, go on. Okay, the Buddha spoke in a language which is very similar to Pali. So basically the difference between, say, English and Australian and American. So it would be slightly different words, slightly different intonations, but basically intelligible. So if I were to start in Pali, and the Buddha could hear it, he'd understand exactly what was being said. There was a language which was very similar. Maybe not exactly the same, there'd be some dialectical differences. But It's also true that the Buddha said, he put this down, he said, wherever you go, monks, teach in the local language. So don't have like a religious language where you just teach in one language, translate it into the local language. So that's what we try and do. But we go back to the Pali, because that's like a source, that's the where you can get some understanding of what the Buddha actually said, and then you can understand it, and then you can explain it in your own words. So that's why I use the ship word. I already mentioned the word ship. Because why is that? Because that is the local language of Australia. And anywhere else. So monks should actually use those words. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying that, because Ajahn Chah would do that. My teacher, he would use really, really coarse words. You know, and I haven't got the guts to say some of the things he said, and the similar things in English. And that's one of the reasons why he's a very popular teacher, because everyone could relate to him. You know, he talked like the villagers would talk. So, I mean, that's what you should do. Up to a point. Okay.
Andamayam omakataya sadhukaram dadamase.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.
So, actually, maybe we can do that in English next time. Okay, now let us all say the rejoicing. And Dhammayang, for the Dhamma talk. And Dhammayang Dhamma Kataya Sadhu Karang Tatama Say. So may we all say Sadhu for the Dhamma talk. Yeah, okay. But that'll be its meaning. Now may we all say Sadhu for the Dhamma talk. So that's what we say. Or even Sadhu. Well, actually, Sadhu hasn't got a really good translation. So Sadhu means it's well.